This is Killer Innovations, a show about ideas, creativity, and how you can innovate. Welcome to the Innovator's Garage, where you learn to create your next game-changing killer innovation.
Welcome to Killer Innovations. I'm your host, Phil McKinney. We are still here at CES, here in Las Vegas. We are taking a look at everything going on. We've got actually a repeat guest, Stephen Guggenheimer from Microsoft. You were here in the studio last year talking about Microsoft and what Microsoft was doing in AI. But before we jump into that, I'd like to get just your take on kind of what you're seeing here at CES. You and I have both been here at CES for many, many years, more than I'd ever, I would ever want to admit to, because it would be revealing my age. But this show is a little bit different this year. It's kind of got a little bit packed. It's like crazy traffic in Las Vegas. You do not want to be in Las Vegas this week. But I'd like to get your take on kind of what you're seeing is kind of what's the uniqueness in this week's show versus shows in the past.
You know, it's funny. Two things that come to mind now with both CES, and I see it at Mobile World Congress too,
a little bit,
which is it used to be the Consumer Electronics Show. You came here to see the new devices we were discussing earlier. You came here to figure out what you're going to put in the store the next year. They're just giant tech shows now. And it's not just the consumer electronics or the software folks. You see every industry, automotive, oil and gas, advertising. This is the amalgamation now for tech. So if you do anything with technology, which pretty much every industry and company does, you come here to figure out what you should be doing, what you might be doing, etc. So it's really sort of, it's an interesting cacophony of new tech and everybody trying to sort of show what they're doing. And then the second thing is, usually some theme emerges. You know, sometimes it's wearables. For, you know, 1 year was wearables like 3 years ago. 1 year was the year of the drones like 2 years ago. Last year, 5G was pretty hot, and I can't remember what the other thing was. This year, nothing's really sort of popped through for me. So just a lot of different things, but nothing's popped.
Well, I think you're right. I think what this year it turns out to be is a little bit of a mashup. Everything out there, you can't walk past the booth and not see whatever their product is. AI 5G.
Yeah.
I mean, they just tack it on like you.
Right.
You can't have a valid booth unless you've got some way to weave in AI and 5G.
Yep.
You know, into the story, and it's we're parked here. We have great positioning here at the show. We're right across from Google, and the line to get into the Google space is unbelievable. And it's basically a smart house. And we were talking before we started recording about the fact that, you know, people come here to the show and they're like, oh my gosh, this is great new stuff. And you and I were laughing like, no, not really. You know, we can show you stuff we were doing in 05 and 08 and 2010.
Lots of smart homes.
Right, a lot of smart home stuff.
That's the one thing that I think is interesting. If you look at the booth, you know, your large sort of Sharp, Panasonic, you know, television folks still there. But the rest has changed. You see the, you know, new Chinese companies coming in. You see startups that have gotten good funding. You see the, you know, the Googles and the Amazons who didn't exist here 15 years ago.
Right.
So you see a sort of a demographic change. Thematically, you know, smart everything, AI, mixed reality. I saw, you know, quantum popping it set up in a few places.
Yep.
So
yep.
If you look at the themes of the world today, AR, MR, blockchain, IoT, AI, quantum. All right, well, let's wander around the halls and play bingo, and we're all in.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were lamenting, or not lamenting, but actually happy that both of our companies, when I was at HP and you're still at Microsoft, made the call not to do the booze here at CES, because it's just hard to get above the noise level. How does a startup ever get any kind of attention in the craziness that's here or having to be over in the sands? It's just impossible to get any kind of recognition.
Yeah, unless you have something sort of earth-shattering from a news perspective that drives some hype, I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, we run our own little area over there. Side meetings go great. Like, one of the beauties of this show, and I would say the same again for Europe, is the everybody's here. So it saves me on travel immensely, because I can see sort of any of the, whether it's customers or ISVs or partners you want to catch up with. So that part's awesome.
Right.
Trying to do it on the show floor, forget it. Man,
yeah, so it almost becomes less. The show just seems to be the attractor.
Right.
The real impact is your ability to have everybody here.
Right.
And you can crank through a bunch of meetings, which that would take you four or 5 months if you had to go out and actually get on and strap yourself into a plane and go do the visits.
You know, Taiwan, from our old OEM days, Taiwan, Japan, Korea, China. I mean, I can hit them all here. All the ODMs, all the OEMs. from an ISV perspective, all the large ones are here. And yep. then, you know, you look across, you see Ford sitting there advertising. So pick your automotive company. Aptiv's across the street here. You know, pick your industry, and you're in sports. I see a lot of sports folks here.
Yeah, in fact, we just had Bob O'Donnell in here, you know, right before you came into the studio. And he and I were talking about the new Bell helicopter. Have you gone over there and seen that thing?
I didn't see it. I heard about it.
Oh, my gosh. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. But, you know, the thing is massive. Right. I mean, it is not, you know, they're promoting it as a flying car.
I saw the pictures.
It'd be the size of my studio here, and my studio is 44 feet long.
Yeah,
you know that's how big that puppy is. It looks gorgeous,
super cool.
But you know, one of the things I'd be interested in getting your thoughts on is you know, we talked before a little bit about, you know, kind of the themes. We used to see what I would call a lot of overhype. You know, people making a lot of promises on mm-hmm. what the technology is going to be able to deliver. Are we seeing as much of that anymore? I mean, some could argue 5G is a little bit on the overhype piece.
I can argue AI probably had a little bit of overhyping going on, just broadly. I see less of companies sticking their necks out as far as they used to.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's too many people that will call them on it. I think this stuff is tracked more closely than it used to be. And it's you know, if you're going to do it to break through, you're going to get called on it. And, you know, the world is you know, much noisier in the sense yep. of there's more press to track, more people to track, you know, nothing is erased.
Right. And
you can't
hide.
Take it back.
And you can't hide.
So I see less sticking next out. I do still see a decent amount of hype. If you looked at the VR work from 3 years ago, like every one of our thematic years, VR pretty overhyped its year, you know, smart, everything kind, you know, all the wearables kind of overhyped its year. The 5G a little bit overhyped its year, you know, AI. So each of these goes through a wave. I see less from a company perspective, in some ways, more of the press and the, in particular, press that's not technical.
Right.
You know, it blows up, it ends up on the TV, back in Washington. You know, what's new at CES? The person riding their bike and falling over, that was some funny meme on the, you know, and having the vest blow up so they don't get hurt. I mean, there's so less by company, I think more by theme.
Well, I think we were over at Showstoppers last night. You know, checking out some of the new companies there to potentially have them on the show. And you look at the sheer amount of press covering the industry, and we talk about, you know, you get into the national debate about fake news. I think the tech industry suffers from a little bit of clickbaity news.
Right.
Right? You know, the reporter basically is measured on their ability to write clickbait headlines than meaningful content. And now I know I'm going to get some heat. I mean, some reporters are going to hear this and they're going to be like all over me on this one. But I think it's a challenge, right? Because, you know, they're trying to, you know, I think you're right. I think maybe the news cycle is driving some of this over expectation. It kind of burns the consumer out because the consumer says, okay, this is the third year I've heard about autonomous vehicles.
That's right.
Fourth year I've been hearing about AI.
Yep.
And then it's kind of like old hat. And it's kind of, you get in that trough of disillusionment before, you know, it becomes real.
I think both those are true. I see a lot of trough of disillusionment because the hype gets, you know, too far ahead of itself for any of these technology areas. And in the 1 year time frame, it's old news.
Yeah.
In the 5 year time frame, a lot more will happen than people expect.
Right. Well, you and I were talking before about, you know, we both have done, you know, these for years have been doing these vision videos to try to help people understand the work that we're doing. It's not, you can't do an innovation in kind of a 90-day cycle. You know, these are multi-year kind of long commits, big dollar kind of, you're making some pretty significant investments. And, you know, so you have to tell these visions in order to convey what that vision is, but then also set that realistic expectation of when is that really going to become meaningful.
I don't think the press does that very well.
No.
The broad press. The way I spend a lot of time at it. I always say that when we grew up, you know, we had our three building blocks, compute, storage, and networking. When I got a 286, you wanted a 386. When you got a 386, you wanted a 486. Then, you know, same for storage from the 5.25, 3.5, iOmega, you remember those? And then,
Man, I still got my stack of iOmegas.
Yep. I still have to remind people that networking, when I started, meant you came in on the weekends to use the network. So 2G, 3G. So those were our building blocks. We went client, server, internet, cloud, mobile, et cetera. The kids coming out of school today, that's not their building blocks.
No.
You go back to that IoT, AI, blockchain. So in a 1 year time frame, not very far, you give that the new generation 25 years or 20 years with those building blocks and ask us where we'll end up and go create the video for that. Holy crud.
Yeah.
Like, we're coming off of the sort of the edge of one wave of building blocks, and we've got a new wave of building blocks that are phenomenally more powerful and sort of interesting.
Yep.
But we're just starting. And so yep. that consumer-y hype cycle, like, you got to get out of the hype cycle of the AI thing today or the mixed reality thing. Give people a horizon. Help them understand that this is a new generation of building blocks that we're going to build on.
Yep. We're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Steve Guggenheim. We are listening to Kill Innovations on the BizTalk Radio Network, and we'll be right back after this break.
This is Killer Innovations, a show about ideas, creativity, and how you can innovate. Welcome to the Innovator's Garage, where you learn to create your next game-changing killer innovation.
Welcome back to Killer Innovations. So, Steve, we were talking before about everything going on at CES, but I'd like to also spin this a little bit and talk about what's going on at Microsoft. I mean, you've been there for a long time. You've had a variety of different roles. Yep. You and I worked pretty closely together when you had the OEM side of the business, yep. and I had my role at HP, but you've transitioned. Last year yep. when you were here, we were talking about, you know, all the work that Microsoft is doing in the AI space. So, yep. so what's going on?
Doing two things. It's funny, everything's circular in some way. So I still spend half my time on AI, and we could spend a few minutes on that, but it's just an ongoing conversation. And then I'm spending about half my time back with the software ecosystem. I've done a ton of work with ISVs over the years in the hardware side as well. Right. And if we look at the stack, you know, there's been a lot of migration for infrastructure ISVs, for a ton of ISVs to SaaS. But there's still a generation of line of business, traditional sort of ISVs, whether they're client server or cloud mobile or, you know, whatever, that are making that journey to SaaS. And we've done a pretty good job of sort of adjusting our platform to help them. So I'm out with line of business ISVs, helping them understand, you know, how can we be useful? You know, what are all the layers in the platform that we offer that they might want to take advantage of? And so spending a ton of time with ISVs and then spending the rest of the time on AI. So it's a funny, weird mix, but it's what I do.
But they actually are somewhat converging though, right? I mean, the ISV roles on the AI side, right?
It all ends up being
just become one of the tools.
It just becomes a tool.
It becomes a tool across yeah. really the whole suite.
Yeah. So the way I look at it on the AI side is for all the building blocks we discussed earlier,
right.
look, they're becoming new layers in the stack. So if I take AI, you know, we've got our compute, storage, and networking. Well, AI is sort of becoming a hardened layer. You know, the cognitive services are going from research projects to early APIs. So now it sits in the Azure team,
mm-hmm.
run by Eric Boyd. I mean, they run a monthly, you know, review on these things where we're looking at, you know, are we 5.9s on, you know, uptime? Are we available in all the core languages? Over time, can we run not just in the cloud, but on the edge? Can you run all the way out at the endpoint? So for us, edge being Azure Stack, can you run all the way out at the edge in terms of an actual device, a speaker or a camera?
Mm-hmm.
So you're doing all of the things to take what was research projects by different groups and turn it into a new layer, cognitive services, the bot framework or the virtual agent, the machine learning workbench, you know, and so you're enhancing all the layers.
Right.
You're adding FPGAs for compute. You're doing things at the data layer. But then at the top, you've got a new layer in the stack that all developers can take advantage of. And so I don't care whether I'm a line of B ISV, if I'm a commercial developer, if I work in a company, you've got a new layer in the stack to use. You can decide to use it or not.
Yeah, this is interesting, though, because let me ask you a question about the rate of that adoption, though, right? Because you're saying you're taking things that are in the research side,
mm-hmm.
and you're enhancing that stack.
Mm-hmm.
That cycle time is getting pretty short, isn't it?
Yes and no. I mean, we started, I did my first natural language processing demo here at CES probably in 2002. So the number of times I've done speech recognition demos is pretty high. I think what's happened is if you look at the three basics for AI today, like you know, the fact that we have the cloud means any developer, any data scientist, anywhere on the planet can build and train models. That just didn't used to exist. You've got data coming out of your pores, so you got data everywhere. But the rate of change for the algorithms, the models, that's the thing that's accelerated immensely.
Right.
And having unique models for, or tools now for computer, you know, computer vision versus natural language processing versus, information classification, that is rapidly advancing. The MRC, like if you look at the machine reading and comprehension tool sets, whether it's the squad leaderboard or any of the leaderboards, the innovation there, super fast. And we can take that pretty quickly and bring it into the cognitive services or in the products. And so that's the one area where I see, you know, that twitch is high now.
Well, it's interesting because in AI, everybody kind of thinks of it as one thing.
Yeah.
Right? But AI is made up of this whole plethora of capabilities. Based on what you're seeing, you kind of have a front row seat.
Yep.
What are kind of the more popular elements of AI that are getting kind of that early traction? And what are some of those things that you think are going to lag here a little bit?
I think what will lag is sort of the more complex integrated scenarios, because to your point, most, you know, NLP is very different than computer vision, is very different than other, you know, areas. I tend to see a couple of patterns that have been popping. You know, one of them is the use of virtual agents. Everybody and their mother is creating the bot to do something. Most of them aren't very good, but that ability to sort of have a virtual agent represent your business over time, proactive, reactive, conversational, that pattern is emerging. So that's one. The notion of AI enhancing sort of different professionals' tools. So if you're a lawyer helping you write contracts, if you're in marketing helping you sort of target people better, if you're in sales figuring out from the list of leads who to call, if you're doing forecasting, if you're a doctor. So AI enhanced tools for different professionals, people are working on those. Knowledge management, can I take a broad set of information or repository and make it easier to build a graph out of it and find information? Autonomous systems obviously pops pretty heavily. And then there's one, sort of the combination of computer vision and other tools that allow me to essentially digitize a physical space and then apply, use AI to digitize a space to start with, so to understand who's in the room, what they're saying, what they're doing, and then apply AI over, you know, on top of it for prediction. My simple example is, look, face recognition and log into a PC. Why can't I use face recognition to walk into a building?
Right.
If I can know who's in a building, if a fire alarm goes off, can I tell who's come out?
Right.
If I know who's in a building and, you know, and there's other things going on, can I make sure somebody doesn't get hurt safely?
Right.
And so you have these interesting patterns that emerge, and people take baby steps with each one of them. And depending which company and which industry, we usually end up on one of them and off we go.
So in this case, these are all distinct elements. Mm-hmm. When do you think they start?
That's the hard part.
They start bringing them all together. Not all of them, but
even some of them.
Some of them.
I think over time, we have a lot of conversations with people about, okay, what happened last year is everybody took one of the patterns. They took some data. They put it off to the side. They created a model or built a virtual agent or whatever. They ran it. They felt pretty good because it did something. Mm-hmm. But then they went back to the CFO and tried to get money, and it doesn't sort of fit into the broader commercial thing. It wasn't enough to justify it. So now I'm like, okay, last year was like, we'll call it cool AI. This year, let's talk about pragmatic AI. And then we get into, okay, let's build a long-term asset here. It's a new layer. So let's have a couple logical conversations. First off, BI before AI. Like if you've got data, if you're not looking for insight, let's not try and add intelligence.
Yeah.
So, is your data in order to do something with?
Yep.
And then, like, build by partner. What do you actually want to build yourself versus, use what others have? And then where do you want to do something custom? And then, you want to build a business out of it. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, perfect. And that becomes the important issue, right? Of what do you build versus where do you take advantage of really the right expertise that you can bring together, whether it be, Microsoft tools or other expertise in order to make this all work. We're going to take another quick commercial break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Stephen here and continue. And I always call you Steven, but you always want to be called Goog.
You can call me whatever you want.
We'll be right back after this commercial break. We'll be right back.
This is Killer Innovations, a show about ideas, creativity, and how you can innovate. Welcome to the Innovator's Garage, where you learn to create your next game-changing killer innovation.
Welcome back. So, Steve, we were talking before with regards to, you know, how does this all get stitched together? There's a lot of companies out there who kind of see the promise of AI, but they're not quite sure how to engage, what they should even be thinking about, or what is kind of a step process to really understand, is it right for them and how do they go about it? So what advice would you give somebody if they're thinking about an AI element to their business, to their products, to their technologies?
You know, it's a couple fold, which is, first off, you have to decide, hey, you know, do I want to use AI to run my company better? Like, I can think about forecasting, marketing, sales, et cetera, back to build by partner, you know, what should I do there? But, you know, let me think about, you know, do I want to invest in that? And if so, where and how? And then for my products themselves, where do I want to infuse AI? And you have to start with, what business are you in? Like, how do you differentiate yourself? What do you, you know, what do you want to have value for or provide as value to your customers? And if AI is not helping that, just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it.
Exactly.
Like any other new technology.
Right.
And so, you know, I feel like last year we got through a bit of the hype cycle, let people get excited, let them go build something. Now let's get practical. Let's look at, like, where do you have unique capabilities from a development standpoint? Like, are you, you know, do you use computer? Do you have people who know computer vision? Do you have unique assets in the image space? Or, you know, what is your unique data asset? Is it around customer care? Is it around how you build products? Mm. And then are you building a long-term asset versus a short-term asset? So let's get that balance right. Let's pick one or two scenarios. Let's decide if it's, whether it's how you run your business or how you, you know, the products you build, or maybe one of each. Let's pick one of the patterns. Let's make sure we're building a long-term data asset, and let's go forward.
Mm. And what are the most common reasons someone who starts down the path of thinking about AI, the most common reasons why projects are not successful? Kind of the,
right,
you know, postmortems, people crash and burn.
They're all bespoke. You know, the excitement says, oh, I can do, you know, I can do something new or unique. There's two things that occur. One is you do this bespoke project where you've pulled the data off to the side, you went and built a model, or you went and built a virtual agent, or you did something. But the data is no longer part of the core data asset. It's, you don't have a data pipeline that supports it. It's kind of cool and one off, but it sort of handled 80-20, but you have no answer for the 20% long tail. Mm-hmm. It doesn't drive enough value that the CFO is going to invest. So you just sort of, you did something, you feel good about it, but it's not justifiable for long term. And so it just sort of, I hear more about POCs that got started and people felt pretty good about them, but they couldn't keep them going.
So is it, in this case, is it a POC because I want to have a nice, cool demo and therefore I don't think beyond the demo?
That, or we want to say we're doing AI, so we wanted to show something for our board or for our CXO.
Yeah.
So we wanted to show what we could do, and it turns out this is the thing that was most readily available, so we did it, or it's where we had expertise, even though it's not necessarily core to the business.
Right.
You know, people who have been at this longer, you'll see what happens is they do a little bit of that, and then they say, okay, let's come back to the fundamentals. Like, maybe we should use ML for forecasting a little better, or supply chain, or, you know, figure it out. The second, you know, place where people sort of run into a struggle is they get sort of ahead of their skis. So they have this grandiose vision about what can be done, but the technology, fine, it might be there, but you better be ready to go hire a university full of researchers, because you're way ahead of the curve relative to what the core platform components will provide and where your skills or your data, you know, reside. And so the vision's awesome, but the path is, like, not well thought through. And so you've got you create the great video, but you don't have the 10-year time horizon.
Right.
That's the other place.
Well, I think people get hung up on the what, forget about focusing on the how.
Yeah.
You know, and do you have really the resources, or does your partner have access to those resources?
You have the data.
And do you have the financial means, and do you have executive patience?
Right.
Because the patience is the one thing that I see, at least on any innovation, whether it's AI or anything else. Patience is the thing that, if you don't have it, you're in the C levels. Doesn't matter how good your vision is or how good you are even on the execution. The odds of you being successful get to about zero really, really fast.
That's right. And that's why it comes back to, okay, what business are you in? How do you differentiate yourself? How then is AI going to complement that or help you? As opposed to some, I'm going to start a new business based on AI, which is, you know, I don't have the people, the skills, or I mean, a lot of the stuff just isn't well thought out.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, there's a good backup on that now that's, again, pragmatic. We got through that cycle. AI is going to add an incredible amount of value for many companies, many industries. Funny, one question I get a lot is like, which industry is, you know, ahead for AI? It's not about the industry. It's about the size of the companies. Turns out the larger organizations, whether it's FinServ or retail or telco, et cetera, have the data and the resources and sort of the patience to make and think about the longer term investments. Where if I'm a mom and pop grocery store in the UK, I have neither this skill set nor the investment capability.
Right. What have, in the work that you've been doing on AI, have people been inquiring more about the issues of ethical AI and the whole issues of how do you, you know, bias in the learning data sets? Because I know that's been come a big conversation.
Yep.
Where's kind of that thinking at, given, is it a big issue that should be worried about?
It's an important issue that everybody should have a viewpoint on. So one of the things we've done, you know, Brad Smith and our team, we published a book, The Future Computed, our principles around ethics for AI. There's seven of them. And it's not up to Microsoft to define the ethics of anything, but it's putting a position out there so we can have a conversation. At the end of the day, we... being, you know, any company in any industry are going to have conversations between industries, between government, and between groups in society that are going to want to talk about this. And if you don't provide a framework for the conversation, you're just going to be absorbing. So every Fortune 1000 company I talk to, the last section is on sort of AI and ethics and how to think about it. And whether you use our framework or you have your own, I don't really care. But you better be prepared to have a conversation to your employees, to your customers, to your partners, and a journey, you know, path on that that you're willing to stand up for and be part of.
Right. Because that, you know, the thing that people who are not familiar with AI aren't really aware of, they think that AI is just neutral, but not realizing that in the data, even the selection of how your data set gets structured to develop your learning models.
Yeah.
You inherently pick up human bias through the selection process of the training data. Yeah.
Bias in the data, bias in the output.
Exactly.
And, you know, we've experienced it firsthand in sort of some of the virtual agents we built. you see it in image recognition. Brad Smith has sort of gone up to Congress relative to how to use face recognition, you know, how it should be used and how to think about it. Because, you know, well, there is bias today.
His testimony was really interesting because he was really hammering on the fact of be careful.
Yeah.
Careful what you wish for.
Yep.
Because of some of the real downside risk on it. I thought he did a really good job on trying to explain it.
Very, very thoughtful.
And explain the risk on that.
I think that's where we've tried to take, I think, a leadership position, at least enabling the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, again, it's not up to us to define something, but, you know, some companies are going to have to sort of lean in relative to the creating a framework for discussion, because it is going to be a discussion.
I think this also exposes the whole conversation that's happening in the Valley right now. About ethical innovation.
Yep.
Right? And the misuse of innovations, right? And now, in fact, you know, we hear a lot about, you know, privacy and security now, and the consumer's mind has come from I'll accept the fact that I'm giving up a certain amount of privacy because I get this
something for free.
And now they're realizing, you know, well, my information is more valued to me than that service is for free to me.
That's right.
And I want to be part of, and the consumer wants to be part of that conversation. They want that transparency, but AI, it's hard to give that transparency in some cases.
It's unfortunately because the models, you know, when you're dealing with a neural network that's 100 layers deep, it's not easy. I mean, part of the challenge we run into is if you take our parents' generation's understanding of how computers work, it's kind of tough.
Yeah.
Take our generation's understanding of how AI works, kind of tough.
It's kind of tough, yes. So, Steve, if people want to keep track of what you're working on and what Microsoft's working on, where's the best place they can keep up with it?
They can go to Microsoft.com/AAI. They can follow me on LinkedIn. We blog pretty regularly. You can follow me on Twitter.
Great. We'll have all those links up on the show notes. Steve, I greatly appreciate you taking your time out of this craziness called CES to spend some time with us here in the studio. And as always, it's been a real pleasure. Appreciate your insight. We're going to take yet another quick commercial break. Don't go anywhere. In segment 4, we'll have a new episode of 5 Minutes to New Ideas. which is where we pose funny, crazy, strange questions in hopes of giving you a little bit of unique insight into whatever problem or opportunity you're working on. So you're not going to want to miss that. So check that out. As I mentioned, we will also have all the links and the notes up in the show notes up at killerinnovations.com. So check that out. We'll be right back after this quick commercial break. You're listening to Killer Innovations on BizTalk Radio.
This is Killer Innovations, a show about ideas, creativity, and how you can innovate. Welcome to the Innovator's Garage, where you learn to create your next game-changing killer innovation.
This segment of the show is what I call 5 minutes to new ideas, designed for the creative mind looking for that next great idea. Each episode will challenge you to think differently about yourself, your business, and your product and services by asking unique, funny, and sometimes crazy questions. These questions are designed to force you to look beyond the obvious and to uncover ideas and opportunities you never before considered. So get out your notebook and be ready to uncover that game-changing idea. Here is 5 minutes to new ideas. What input, if you were able to reduce it, would allow you to cut the price for your product or service by 25%. Now, there's a reason that the percentage in this question is as high as it is. Sure, it would sound less scary and more reasonable if I asked you if you could cut your price by 5% or maybe 8%, but that would be missing the point. If you want to potentially be game-changing moves to get ahead of your competition, you need to make big savings and do something bold to get to that leader of the pack position. The best place to find these kinds of savings is in your biggest input cost. Don't settle for parity. Look for those things that are as necessary evil in your business and see if you can turn them into a competitive advantage instead. If you and your competitors have the same basic cost structure and you can slash yours by a major innovation, well, you get the picture. You need to continually look at ways to drastically lower the price of your product, because if you don't, it's possible that your competitors will. If you've ever driven in India, you've probably had some alarming near-death encounters with the brightly painted Tata trucks that fill the highways. They are huge, and rather than using their braking system, they rely on their horns to get other cars out of the way. About 8 years ago, Tata decided to enter the passenger vehicle market, despite the logistical difficulties of making the leap from manufacturing trucks to lightweight single-family cars. The car they came up with, the Nano, uses a two-cylinder engine and much less sheet metal than a comparable vehicle. Its trunk can hold one small bag, and it lacks a passenger side mirror. In other words, anything that is not strictly necessary to fulfill the mission of getting a family from point A to point B has been cut out of this product. They are currently selling a car priced at under $2,000 in the Indian market. The cars have some issues. They are small, slow, and seem prone to catching on fire at inopportune times. Still, Tata is coming to the U.S. market, and despite some production setbacks in India, it clearly has ambitions to succeed here. If they do, it will radically change the nature of the domestic car industry. Would you buy your kid a $13,000 starter car if a similar model were $5,000 cheaper? U.S. car companies have an opinion about who their customer is and what their customers expect to get from and to pay for when it comes to a car. And this could prove very dangerous for Detroit if Tata figures out how to connect with U.S. drivers and start making meaningful sales. If U.S. car companies are going to defend themselves against hungry, aggressive competitors like Tata and their Chinese equivalents, they need to be careful, very careful. These companies have no assumptions or expectations about how they might sell their cars in the United States, nor do they have a history of hitting certain price points or any expectations that a car is only worth selling if it brings a certain amount of profit. They have different philosophies of what a car needs to be in order to satisfy their customer. What if the U.S. customer starts to agree with them? Look at the history of unrest in the Middle East and the resulting upswing in oil prices. Suppose things got worse, not better. A company that knows how to use minimal materials and resources to build ultra-cheap, ultra-fuel-efficient cars and isn't afraid to charge rock-bottom prices for them is going to have a huge advantage in the U.S. marketplace. It will take a cognitive sidestep for Detroit to respond to ultra-cheap imports from the third world. Hopefully, you are willing to take that kind of a sidestep both to develop your product and to ensure you aren't leaving any gaps for a competitor to sneak some kind of game changer into the marketplace. So ask yourself, what input, if reduced, would allow me to cut the price by 25%? Now, if you're able to achieve this objective, then raise it. Could you find savings that would allow you to cut the price to, oh, I don't know, 30%, maybe even 40%? This is a question that you should never stop asking yourself, because if you do, your competition may pass you right by. I'm Phil McKinney, and thanks for listening. Thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join in. If you have any comments or suggestions, drop me a note at phil@killerinnovations.com. Beyond this show, I write about my personal experiences of being in the innovation game for the last two decades. Topics include innovation, creativity, culture, team building, metrics, frustrations, leadership, and how to win. You can find that content over at philmckinney.com. You can also find out information about my book, Beyond the Obvious, including extensive excerpts over at beyondtheobvious.com. You can find hardcover, digital, and audio versions of my book on Amazon or wherever you get your books from. Now, the reason I started this show back in 2005 was to pay back my early mentor. My first mentor, Bob Davis, invested an immense amount of time in training and coaching me, which had a major impact on my career. When I went back and asked him how I could pay him back, he laughed and said I couldn't. I had to pay it forward. If I could ask for a favor, could you help me pay it forward? How? One, by giving us a rating wherever you get your podcast, as that helps spread the word. And two, by telling others about the show. If you want to be part of the conversation between the shows, I hang out in the Innovators community on Slack. The Innovators community is a private community of vetted innovators who help each other succeed. Check it out at theinnovators.community. This episode of Kill Innovations was produced by the Innovators Network. You can find the show notes and the entire show catalog going back to 2005 at killerinnovations.com. I'll talk to you next week. In the meantime, go out and change the world with your innovation.